Hartman, and has no time to send to me, to tell me where to meet him. He cannot even write to me to tell me where he is going. I doubt that he knows himself. All he is doing is getting away from certain death. Thoughts of how to return will come later. Now, tonight, the king is running for his life. Autumn, 1470. The news comes to London in unreliable rumors, and it is all, always bad. Warwick lands in England, as Edward predicted, but what he did not predict is the rush of nobles to the traitor's side, in support of the king they have left to rot in the Tower for the last 5 years. The Earl of Shrewsbury joins him. Jasper Tudor, who can raise most of Wales, joins him. Lord Thomas Stanley, who took the ruby ring at my coronation joust and told me that his motto was without changing, joins him. A whole host of lesser gentry follow these influential commanders, and Edward is swiftly outnumbered in his own kingdom. All the Lancaster families are finding and polishing their old weapons, hoping to march out to victory once again. It is as he warned me. He could not spread out the wealth quickly enough, fairly enough, to enough people. We could not spread the influence of my family far enough, deep enough. And now they think they will do better under Warwick and the mad old king than under Edward and my family. Edward would have been killed on the spot if they had caught him. But they have missed him. That much is clear. But nobody knows where he is. And someone comes to the Tower once a day to assure me that they have seen him and that he was dying of his wounds, or that they have seen him and he is fleeing to France, or that they have seen him on a bier and he is dead. My boys arrive at the Tower, travel-stained and weary, furious that they did not get away with the king. I try not to hang on to them or kiss them more often than morning and night, but I can hardly believe that they have come safely back to me, just as I cannot believe that my husband and my brother have not. I sent to Grafton for my mother to come to us in the Tower. I need her advice and company, and if we are indeed lost and I have to go abroad, I will want her with me. But the messenger comes back, and his face is grave. "Your lady mother is not at her home," he says. "Where is she?" He looks shifty, as if he wishes someone else could tell me bad news. "Tell me at once," I say, my voice sharp with fear. "Where is she?" "She is under arrest," he says. "Orders of the Earl of Warwick. He has ordered her arrest, and his men came to Grafton and took her away." "Warwick has my mother?" I can hear my heart thudding in my ears. "My mother is a prisoner." "Yes." I hear a rattling noise, and I see that my hands are shaking so badly that my rings are clicking against the arms of the chair. I take a breath to steady myself, and grip tight to stop myself shaking. My son Thomas comes closer to stand on one side of my chair. Richard steps up to the other. "On what charge?" I think, it cannot be treason. Nobody could argue that my mother has done more than advise me. Nobody could charge her with treason when she has been a good mother-in-law to the crowned king and a loving companion to his queen. Not even Warwick could stoop so low as to charge a woman with treason and behead her for loving her daughter. But this is a man who killed my father and my brother without reason. His desire must only be to break my heart and rob Edward of the support of my family. This is a man who will kill me if he ever gets hold of me. "I am so sorry, Your Grace." "What charge?" I demand. My throat is dry, and I give a little cough. "Witchcraft," he says. There is no need of a trial to put a witch to death, though no trial has ever failed. It is easy to find people to witness on oath that their cows died or that their horse threw them because a witch had overlooked them. But in any case, there is no need of either witnesses or a trial. A single priest is all that is needed to attest a witch's guilt. or a lord like Warwick can simply declare her guilty and no one will defend her. Then she can be strangled and buried at the village crossroads. They usually get the blacksmith to strangle the woman, since he, by virtue of his trade, has big, strong hands. My mother is a tall woman, a famous beauty with a long, slim neck. Any man could choke the life out of her in minutes. It does not need to be a brawny blacksmith. Any one of Warwick's guard could easily do it, would do it in a moment, on a word, gladly on Warwick's word. Where is she? I demand. Where has he taken her?
Nobody at Grafton knew where they were going, the man says. I asked everyone. A troop of horse came, and they made your mother ride pillion behind their commanding officer, and they took her north. They told no one where they were going. They just said that she was under arrest for witchcraft.
I must write to Warwick, I say quickly. Go and eat and get a fresh horse. I shall need you to travel as fast as you can. Are you ready to leave at once?
At once, he says, bows and goes out.
I write to Warwick, demanding her release. I write to every archbishop we once commanded, and anyone who I think would speak for us. I write to my mother's old friends and family attached to the House of Lancaster. I even write to Margaret Beaufort, who, as the heir of the House of Lancaster, may have some influence. Then I go to my chapel, the Queen's Chapel, and I get down on my knees all night to pray that God will not allow this wicked man to take this good woman, who is blessed with nothing more than a sacred foresight, a few pagan tricks, and a total lack of deference. At dawn, I write her name on a dove's feather and send it floating downstream to warn Melusina that her daughter is in danger. Then I have to wait for news. For a whole week I have to wait, hearing nothing and fearing the very worst. Daily, people come to tell me that my husband is dead. Now I fear they will say the same of my mother, and I will be utterly alone in the world. I pray to God. I whisper to the river. Someone has to save my mother. Then, at last, I hear that she is freed, and 2 days later she comes to me in the tower. I run into her arms, and I cry as if I were her daughter of 10 years old. She holds me, and she rocks me as if I was still her little girl. And when I look up into her beloved face, I see there are tears on her own cheeks.
I'm safe, she says.
He didn't hurt me. He didn't put me to question. He held me only for a few days.
Why did he let you go? I ask.
I wrote to him, I wrote to everybody, I prayed and I wished, but I didn't think he would show you any mercy.
Margaret d'Anjou, she answers with a wry smile.
Of all the women in the world, she commanded him to release me as soon as she heard that he had arrested me. We were good friends once, and we are kinswomen still. She remembered my service at her court, and she ordered Warwick to release me or face her extreme displeasure.
I give an incredulous laugh.
She commanded him to release you, and he obeyed.
She is his daughter's mother-in-law now, as well as his queen, my mother points out.
And he is her sworn ally, and counting on her army to support him as he recaptures the country. And I was her companion when she came to England as a bride, and her friend through all the years of her queenship. I was of the House of Lancaster then, as we all were, until you married Edward.
It was good of her to save you, I concede.
This is a cousin's war indeed, my mother says. We all have those we love on the other side. We all have to face killing our own family. Sometimes we can be merciful. God knows she is not a merciful woman, but she thought she would be merciful to me. I am sleeping uneasily in the rich royal apartments of the Tower of London, the flicker of moonlight reflected from the river onto the drapes over my bed. I am lying on my back, the weight of the baby heavy on my belly, an ache in my side, drifting between sleep and wakefulness, when I see as bright as moonlight on the arras above me. My husband's face, gaunt and aged, bent low over the galloping mane of his horse, riding like a madman through the night, less than a dozen men around him. I give a little cry and turn on the pillow. The rich embroidery presses against my cheek, and I sleep again. But again I wake to the image of Edward riding hard through darkness on a strange road. I half wake, crying out against the picture in my mind. And as I drift between sleeping and wakefulness, I see a small fishing port. Edward, Anthony, William, and Richard hammering on a door, arguing with a man, hiring his boat, forever looking over their shoulders to the west for their enemies. I hear them promise the ship's master anything, anything, if he will launch his little ship and take them to Flanders. I see Edward strip off his great coat of furs and offer it as payment. "Take it," he says. "It's worth more than your boat twice over. Take it, and I will think it a service." "No," I say in my sleep. "Edward is leaving me, leaving England, leaving me and breaking his word that he would be with me for the birth of our son." The seas are high outside the harbor, the dark waves topped with white foam. The little ship rises and falls, rolling between the waves, water breaking over the bows. It seems impossible that it should climb to the top of the waves, and then it crashes down in the troughs. Edward stands at the stern, clutching to the side for support, thrown about by the movement of the boat, looking back at the country he called his own, watching for the flare of the torches of the men coming after him. He has lost England. We have lost England. He claimed the throne, and he was crowned king. He crowned me as queen, and I believed that we were established. He never lost a battle. But Warwick has been too much, too fast, too duplicitous for him. Edward is heading for exile, just as Warwick did. He is heading out into a vicious storm, just as Warwick did. But Warwick went straight to the King of France and found an ally and an army. I cannot see how Edward will ever return. Warwick is back in power, and now it is my husband and my brother Anthony and my brother-in-law Richard who are the fugitives, and God knows what wind will ever blow them back to England again. And the girls and I, and the baby in my belly, are the new hostages, the new prisoners. I may be in the royal apartments of the tower for now, but soon I shall be in the rooms below, with the bars over the window, and King Henry will sleep in this bed again, and I shall be the one who people say should, for Christian charity, be released, so that I do not die in prison without sight of the free sky. Edward. I see him look up, almost as if he can hear me call for him in my sleep, in my dream. Edward! I cannot believe that he could leave me, that we could have lost our fight for the throne. My father laid down his life that I might be queen. My brother died beside him. Are we now to be nothing but pretenders, dismissed after a few years of good luck? A king and a queen who overreached themselves and for whom the luck ran out. Are my girls to be the daughters of an attainted traitor? Are they to marry small squires on country estates and hope to live down their father's shame? Is my mother to greet Margaret of Anjou on her knees and hope to worm her way back into favor again? Am I to have the choice of living in exile or living in prison? And what of my son, the baby not yet born? Is Warwick likely to let him live? He who lost his own grandson and only heir as we closed the gates of Calais to him? His daughter losing her baby in rough seas with a witch's wind blowing them on shore. I scream out loud, "Edward, don't leave me!" And the terror in my voice starts me into full wakefulness, and next door my mother lights a candle from the fire and opens the door. "Is he coming? The baby, is he early?" "No. I had a dream. Mother, I had a most terrible dream." "There, there, never mind," she says, quick to comfort.
She lights candles at my bedside. She stirs up the fire with a kick from her slippered foot.
There, Elizabeth, you're safe now.
We're not safe, I say certainly.
That's the very thing.
Why, what did you dream?
It was Edward, on a ship in a storm. It was night, the seas were huge. I don't even know if his ship will get through.
It's an ill wind that blows no good, Mother, and he was facing an ill wind. It was our wind. It was the gale we called up to blow George and Warwick away. We called it up, but it has not blown away. Edward is in a storm of our making.
Edward was dressed like a servant, a poor man. He had nothing, nothing but the clothes he stood up in. He had given away his coat.
Anthony was there. He didn't even have his cape. William Hastings was with them, and Edward's brother, Richard. They were all that had survived. They were all that could run. They were... I close my eyes, trying to remember.
They were leaving us, Mother.
Oh, Mother, he's left England. He's left us. He's lost. We're lost. Edward has gone. Anthony, too, I'm sure of it.
She takes my cold hands and rubs them in her own.
Perhaps it was just a bad dream, she says.
Perhaps nothing but a dream.
Women with child, near their time, have strange fancies, vivid dreams.
I shake my head. I throw back the covers.
No, I am certain. It was a seeing. He is defeated. He has run away.
Do you think he has gone to Flanders? She asks. To take refuge with his sister, the Duchess Margaret and Charles of Burgundy?
I nod. Of course. Of course he has. And he will send for me, I don't doubt him. He loves me, and he loves the girls, and he swore he would never leave me.
But he has gone, Mother. Margaret of Anjou must have landed, and she will be marching here to London to free Henry.
We have to go. I have to get the girls away. We can't be here when her army comes in. They will imprison us forever if they find us here.
My mother throws a shawl around my shoulders.
Are you sure? Can you travel? Shall I send a message to the docks and shall we take a ship?
I hesitate. I am so afraid of the voyage when my baby is near to his time. I think of Isabel, crying out in pain on a rocking ship, and nobody to help her with the birth. The baby dying, and not even a priest to christen him. I can't face what she had to face, with the wind screaming in the rigging. I am afraid that the wind I whistled up is still blowing down the sea roads, its ill nature unsatisfied by the death of one baby, looking around the horizon for unsteady sails. If that wind sees me and my girls on the heaving seas, then we will be drowned.
No, I can't bear it. I don't dare. I am too afraid of the wind. We'll go into sanctuary. We'll go to Westminster Abbey. They won't dare hurt us there. We'll be safe there. The Londoners love us still, and Queen Margaret wouldn't break sanctuary. If King Henry is in his wits, he would never let her break sanctuary. He believes in the power of God working in the world. He will respect sanctuary and make Warwick leave us alone. We'll take the girls and my grey-sons and go into sanctuary, at least until my son is born.
November 1470. When I had heard of desperate men claiming sanctuary by hanging onto the ring on the church door and yelling defiance at the thief-takers, or dashing up the aisle and putting their hand on the high altar as if they were playing a childhood game of tag, I always thought that they must live thereafter on the wine of the Mass and the bread of the host, and sleep in the pews pillowed on hassocks. It turns out that it is not as bad as this. We live in the crypt of the church built in St. Margaret's churchyard, within the precincts of the abbey. It is a little like living in a cellar, but we can see the river from the low windows on one side of the room, and we can glimpse the highway through the grille in the door on the other side. We live like a poor family, dependent on the goodwill of Edward's supporters and the citizens of London,
who love the family of York and continue to do so, even though the world has changed again, the family of York is in hiding, and King Henry is acclaimed king once more. Warwick, the ascendant Lord Warwick, the murderer of my father and brother and the kidnapper of my husband, enters London in triumph, George, his unhappy son-in-law, at his side. George may be a spy in their ranks, secretly on our side, or he may have turned his coat and turned it again, and now hopes for crumbs from the Lancaster royal table. At any rate, he gets no message to me, nor does anything to guarantee my safety. He bobs along in the wake of the kingmaker, as if he had no brother, no sister-in-law, perhaps still hoping for a chance at being king himself. Warwick, triumphant, takes his old enemy, King Henry, from the tower, and proclaims him fit to rule and fully restored. He is now the liberator of his king, and the savior of the House of Lancaster, and the country is filled with joy. King Henry is confused by this turn of events, but they explain to him, slowly and kindly, once a day, that he is king again, and that his cousin, Edward of York, has gone away. They may even tell him that we, Edward's family, are hiding in Westminster Abbey, for he orders, or they order in his name, that the sanctuary of the holy places shall be observed, and we are safe in our self-imposed prison. Every day the butchers send us meat, the bakers send us bread, even the milkmaids from the green fields of the city bring us pails of milk for the girls, and the fruit sellers from Kent bring the best of the crop to the abbey and leave it at the door for us. They tell the church wardens that it is for the poor queen at her time of trouble, and then they remember that there is a new queen, Margaret of Anjou, only waiting for a fair wind to set sail and return to her throne, and they trip over their words and finally say, "You know who I mean, but make sure she has it, for fruit from Kent is very good for a woman near her time. It will make the baby come easier. And tell her that we wished her well, and we will come again." It is hard for my girls to have so little news of their father, hard for them to be kept inside in the few small rooms since they were born to the best of things. They have lived all their lives in the greatest palaces of England. Now they are confined. They can stand on a bench to look out of the windows at the river, where the royal barge used to take them up and down between one palace and another, or they can take turns to get on a chair and look out of the grating at the streets of London, where they used to ride and hear people bless their names and their pretty faces. Elizabeth, my oldest girl, is only 4 years old, but it is as if she understands that a time of great sorrow and difficulty has come on us. She never asks me where her tame birds are. She never asks for the servants who used to pet her and play with her. She never asks for her golden top, or her little dog, or her precious toys. She acts as if she had been born and bred in this little space, and she plays with her baby sisters as if she were a paid nursemaid, ordered to be cheerful. The only question she poses is, "Where is her father?" And I have to learn to become accustomed to her looking up at me, a little puzzled frown on her round face, asking, "Is my father the king here yet, Lady Mother?" It is hardest of all on my boys, who are like confined lion cubs in the small space, and prowl around, bickering. In the end, my mother sets some exercises, sword play with broom handles, poems to learn, jumping and catching games that they have to do every day, and they keep a score and hope that it will make them stronger in the battle they long for, which will restore Edward to the throne. As the days grow shorter and the nights grow darker, I know that my time is coming and my baby is due. My great terror is that I will die here, in childbirth, and my mother will be left here alone, in our enemy's city, guarding my children. "Do you know what will happen?" I ask her bluntly. "Have you foreseen it? And what will happen to my girls?" I see some knowledge in her eyes, but the face she turns to me is untroubled. "You aren't going to die, if that's what you're asking," she says bluntly. You are a healthy young woman, and the King's Council is sending Lady Scrope to care for you, and a pair of midwives. There is no reason to think that you will die, any more than there was with any of the others. I expect you to survive this, and to have more children. The baby? I ask, trying to read her face. You know he is healthy, she says, smiling. Anyone who has felt that child kick knows he is strong. There is no reason for you to fear. But there is something, I say certainly. You foresee something about Edward, my baby Prince Edward. She looks at me for a moment, and then she decides to speak honestly. I can't see him becoming king, she says. I have read the cards, and I have looked at the reflection of the moon on the water. I have tried asking the crystal and looking into the smoke. Indeed, I have tried everything I know which is inside the laws of God and is allowed in this holy space. But to tell you the truth, Elizabeth, I cannot see him being king. I laugh out loud. Is that it? Is that all? Dear Godmother, I cannot see his own father being king again, and he is crowned and ordained. I cannot see myself being queen again, and I have had the holy oil on my breast and the scepters in my hand. I don't hope for a Prince of Wales here, just a healthy boy. Just let him be born strong and grow to be a man, and I will be content. I don't need him to be King of England. I just want to know that he and I will live through this. Oh, you'll live through this, she says. An airy wave of her hand dismisses the cramped rooms, the girls' truckle beds in one corner, the servants' straw mattresses on the floor in another, the poverty of the space, the chill of the cellar, the damp in the stone of the walls, the smoking fire, the dauntless courage of my children, who are forgetting that they ever lived anywhere better. This is nothing. I expect to see us rise from this. How? I ask her, disbelievingly. She leans over, and she puts her mouth to my ear. Because your husband is not growing vines and making wine in Flanders, she says. He is not carding wool and learning to weave. He is equipping an expedition, making allies, raising money, planning to invade England. The London merchants are not the only ones in the country who prefer York to Lancaster, and Edward has never lost a battle. Do you remember? Uncertainly, I nod. Even though he is defeated and in exile, it is true that he has never lost a battle. So, when he comes against Henry's forces, even when they are captained by Warwick and driven on by Margaret d'Anjou, don't you think he will win? It is not a proper confinement, as a queen should be confined, with a ceremonial retirement from court 6 weeks before the date of the birth, and a closing of the shutters, and a blessing of the room. Nonsense, my mother says buoyantly. You retired from daylight itself, didn't you? Confinement? I should think no queen has ever been so confined. Who has ever been confined to sanctuary before? It is not a proper royal birth with three midwives and two wet nurses, and rockers and noble godmothers and mistresses of the nursery standing by, and ambassadors waiting with rich gifts. Lady Scrope is sent by the Lancaster court to make sure that I have everything I need, and I think this is a gracious gesture from the Earl of Warwick to me. But I have to bring my baby into the world with no waiting husband and court at the door, and almost none to help me. And his godfathers are the Abbot of Westminster and the Prior, and his godmother is Lady Scrope, the only people who are with me, neither great lords of the land nor foreign kings, the usual godfathers for a royal baby, but good and kind people who have been trapped at Westminster with us. I call him Edward, as his father wants, and as the silver spoon from the river predicted. Margaret of Anjou, with her invasion fleet held in port by storms, sends me a message to tell me to call him John. She does not want another Prince Edward in England to rival her son. I ignore her words as from a nobody. Why would I listen to the preferences of Margaret of Anjou? My husband named him Edward, and the silver spoon came from the river with his name on it. Edward he is. Edward, Prince of Wales, he shall be, even if my mother is right, and he is never Edward the King. Among ourselves we call him Baby, and no one calls him the Prince of Wales. And I think, as I drift into sleep after the birth, all warm with him in my arms, half drunk from the birthing cup that they have given me, that perhaps this baby will not be king. There have been no cannons fired for him, and no bonfires lit on hilltops. The fountains and conduits of London have not run with wine. The citizens are not drunk with joy. There are no announcements of his arrival racing to the great courts of Europe. It is like having an ordinary baby, not a prince. Perhaps he will be an ordinary boy, and I will become an ordinary woman again. Perhaps we will not be great people, chosen by God, but just happy. Winter, 1470-71. We spend Christmas in Sanctuary. The London butchers send us a fat goose, and my boys and little Elizabeth and I play cards, and I make sure that I lose a silver sixpence to her, and send her to bed thrilled to be a serious gamester. We spend Twelfth Night in Sanctuary, and Mother and I compose a play for the children, with costumes and masks and enchantments. We tell them our family story of Melusina, the beautiful woman, half girl, half fish, who is found in the fountain in the forest and marries a mortal for love. I wrap myself in a sheet, which we tie at the feet to make a great tail, and I let down my hair, and when I rise up from the floor, the girls are transported by the fishwoman Melusina, and the boys applaud. My mother enters with a paper horse's head taped on the stick of a broom, wearing the doorman's jerkin and a paper crown. The girls don't recognize her at all, and watch the play as if we were paid mummers at the greatest court in the world. We tell them the story of the courtship, of the beautiful woman who is half fish, and how her lover persuades her to leave her watery fountain in the wood, and take her chance in the great world. We tell only half the story, that she lives with him and gives him beautiful children, and they are happy together. There is more to the story than this, of course. But I find that I don't want to think about marriages for love that end in separation. I don't want to think about being a woman who cannot live in the new world that is being made by men. I don't want to think of Melusina rising from her fountain and confining herself to a castle while I am held in sanctuary, and all of us, daughters of Melusina, are trapped in a place where we cannot wholly be ourselves. Melusina's mortal husband loved her, but she puzzled him. He did not understand her nature, and he was not content to live with a woman who was a mystery to him. He allowed a guest to persuade him to spy on her. He hid behind the hangings in her bathhouse, and saw her swim beneath the water of her bath, saw, horrified, the gleam of ripple on scales. Learned her secret, that although she loved him, truly loved him, she was still half woman and half fish. He could not bear what she was, and she could not help but be who she was. So he left her, because in his heart he feared that she was a woman with a divided nature, and he did not realize that all women are creatures of divided nature. He could not stand to think of her secrecy, that she had a life hidden from him. He could not, in fact, tolerate the truth that Melusina was a woman who knew the unknown depths, who swam in them. Poor Melusina, who tried so hard to be a good wife, had to leave the man who loved her and go back to the water, finding the earth too hard. Like many women, she was unable to fit exactly with her husband's view. Her feet hurt. She could not walk in the path of her husband's choosing. She tried to dance to please him, but she could not deny the pain. She is the ancestress of the royal house of Burgundy, and we, her descendants, still try to walk in the paths of men, and sometimes we too find the way unbearably hard. I hear that the new court has a merry Christmas feast. Henry the King is back in his senses, and the House of Lancaster is triumphant. From the windows of the sanctuary we can see the barges going up and down the river as the noblemen go from their riverside palaces to Whitehall. I see the Stanley barge go by. Lord Stanley, who kissed my hand at my coronation tournament and told me his motto was sans changer, was one of the first to greet Warwick when he landed in England. It turns out he is a Lancaster man after all. Maybe he will be unchanging for them. I see the Beaufort barge with the flag of the Red Dragon of Wales flying at the stern. Jasper Tudor, the great power of Wales, is taking his nephew, young Henry Tudor, to court to visit the king, his kinsman. Half outlaw, half prince. Jasper will be back in the castles of Wales again, and Lady Margaret Beaufort will weep tears of joy all over her 14-year-old son, Henry Tudor, I don't doubt. She was parted from him when we put him with the good York guardians, the Herberts, and she had to endure the prospect of his marrying the Yorkist Herbert girl. But now William Herbert lies dead in our service, and Margaret Beaufort has her son back in her keeping. She will be pushing him forward at court, pushing him forward for favours and places. She will want his titles restored. She will want his inheritance guaranteed. George, Duke of Clarence, stole both the title and the lands, and she will have named them in her prayers ever since. She is a most ambitious woman and determined mother. I don't doubt she will have the Earldom of Richmond off George within the year, and if she can, her son will be named as the Lancaster heir after the prince. I see Lord Warwick's barge, the most beautiful on the river, his rowers going in time to the beat of the drummer in the stern, moving swiftly against the tide as if nothing can stop his onward progress, not even the flow of the river. I even make him out, standing in the prow of the boat as if he would rule the very water of the river, his hat pulled off and held in his hand so that he can feel the cold air in his dark hair. I purse my lips to whistle up a wind, but I let him go. It makes no difference. Warwick's older daughter Isabel may be hand in hand with my brother-in-law George in the seats at the back of the barge as they go past my subterranean prison. Perhaps she remembers the Christmas that she came to court as an unwilling bride, and I was kind to her. Or perhaps she prefers to forget the court where I was the Queen of the White Rose. George will know I am here, the wife of his brother, the woman who stayed loyal when he did not, living in poverty, living in half-darkness. He will know I am here. He may even feel me watching him, my narrowed eyes overlooking him, this man who was once George of the House of York and is now a favoured kinsman at the court of Lancaster. My mother puts her hand on my arm. Don't ill-wish them, she warns me. It comes back on you. It is better to wait. Edward is coming, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt him for a moment. This time will be like a bad dream. It is, as Anthony says, shadows on the wall. What matters is that Edward musters an army big enough to defeat Warwick. How can he, I say, looking out at the city that now declares itself all for Lancaster. How can he even begin? He has been in touch with your brothers, and with all our kinsmen. He is raising his forces, and he has never lost a battle. He has never fought Warwick, and Warwick taught him everything he knows about war. He is king, she says. Even if they now say that it meant nothing, he was crowned. He is divinely ordained. He has had the holy oil on his breast. They cannot deny that he is king. Even if another crowned and ordained king sits on the throne. But Edward is lucky, and Henry is not. Perhaps it comes down only to that, if you are a lucky man, and the Yorkes are a lucky house. She smiles. And of course he has us. We can wish him well. No harm in a little spell for good luck. And if that does not improve his chances, then nothing will. Spring, 1471. My mother brews up tisanes and leans from the window and pours them into the river, whispering words that no one can hear, throws powder on the fires to make them burn green and smoke. She never stirs the children's porridge without whispering a prayer, turns her pillow over twice before she gets into bed, claps her shoes together before putting them on to rid them of bad luck. "Does any of it mean anything?" my son Richard asks me, one eye on his grandmother, who is twisting a plait of ribbon and whispering over it. I shrug. "Sometimes," I say. "Is it witchcraft?" he asks nervously. "Sometimes." Then in March my mother tells me, "Edward is coming to you. I am sure of it." "You have foreseen it?" I ask. She giggles. "No, the butcher told me." "What did the butcher tell you? London is filled with gossip." "Yes, but he had a message from a man in Smithfield who serves the ships that go to Flanders. He saw a little fleet sailing northwards in the worst weather, and one of them was flying the Sun in Splendour, the badge of York." "Edward is invading. Perhaps at this very moment." In April, in the early hours of the night, I hear the sound of cheering from the streets outside, and I jump from my bed and go to the window to listen. The abbey serving girl pounds on the door and comes running into the room and babbles, "Your Grace! Your Grace, it is him! It is the King! Not King Henry, the other King! Your King! The York King! King Edward!" I draw my nightgown around me and put my hand to the plait of my hair. "Here! Now, are they cheering for him?" "Cheering for him now," she exclaims, "lighting torches to guide him on his way, singing and throwing down gold coins before him, him and a band of soldiers, and he must be coming here." "Mother, Elizabeth, Richard, Thomas, girls," I call out, "get up, get dressed. Your father is coming, your father is coming to us." I seize the serving girl by the arm. "Get me hot water to wash in, and the best gown I have. Leave the firewood, it doesn't matter. Who's going to sit by that paltry fire ever again?" I push her from the room to fetch the water, and I pull my hair out of the nighttime plait as Elizabeth comes running into my room, her big eyes wide. "Is it the bad queen coming? Lady Mother, is the bad queen here?" "No, sweetheart, we are saved. It is your own good father coming to visit us. Can't you hear them cheering?" I stand her up on a stool to the grill in the door. Then I splash water on my face and twist my hair up under my headdress. The girl brings me my gown and ties it up, fumbling with the ribbons. And then we hear the thunder of his knock at the door, and Elizabeth screams and jumps down to open it, and then falls back as he comes in, taller and graver than she remembers him. And in a moment I have run to him, barefoot as I am, and I am in his arms again. "My son," he demands after he has held me and kissed me and rubbed his rough chin against my cheek. "Where is my son? Is he strong? Is he well?" "He is strong and well. He is 5 months old this month," my mother says, as she brings him in, swaddled tightly, and sweeps Edward a great curtsy. "And you are welcome home, son Edward, your Grace." Gently he puts me aside and goes swiftly to her. I had forgotten that he could move so lightly on his feet, like a dancer. He takes his son from my mother's arms, and though he whispers, "Thank you," he does not even see her. He is quite distracted. He takes the baby over to the light of the window, and baby Edward opens his dark blue eyes and yawns, his rosebud mouth opening wide, and he looks into the face of his father as if to return the intense, gray-eyed scrutiny. "My son," he says quietly. "Elizabeth, forgive me that you had to give birth to him here. I would not have had that for the world." I nod in silence. "And he is baptized and named Edward as I wanted?" "He is. And he thrives." "We are just starting to feed him solid food," my mother says proudly, "and he is taking to it. He sleeps well, and he is a bright, clever boy. Elizabeth has nursed him herself, and no one could have been a better wet nurse to him. We have made you a little prince here." Edward looks at her. "Thank you for his care," he says, "and for staying with my Elizabeth." He looks down. His daughters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Cecily, are gathered around him, gazing up at him as if he were some strange beast, a unicorn, perhaps, who has suddenly cantered into their nursery. Gently he kneels so that he does not tower above them, still holding the baby in the crook of his arm. "And you are my girls, my princesses," he says quietly to them. "Do you remember me? I have been away a long time, more than half a year, but I am your father. I have been away from you for far too long, but there was never a day when I did not think of you and your beautiful mother, and swear that I would come home to you and set you in your rightful places again. Do you remember me?" Cecily's lower lip trembles, but Elizabeth speaks. "I remember you." She puts her hand on his shoulder and looks into his face without fear. "I am Elizabeth. I am the oldest. I remember you. The others are too small. Do you remember me? You're Elizabeth, Princess Elizabeth. One day I shall be Queen of England like my mother." We laugh at that, and he gets to his feet again, hands the baby to my mother, and takes me into his arms. Richard and Thomas step forward and kneel for his blessing. "My boys," he says warmly, "you must have hated it, cooped up in here." Richard nods. "I wish I had been with you, sire." "Next time you shall," Edward promises him. "How long have you been in England?" I ask, my words muffled as he starts to pull my hair down. "Have you an army?" "I came with your brother and with my true friends," he says. "Richard, my brother, your brother Anthony, Hastings, of course, the ones who went into exile with me. And now others are coming to my side. George, my brother, has left Warwick and will fight for me. He and Richard and I embraced each other as brothers once more, before the very walls of Coventry, under the nose of Warwick. George has brought Lord Shrewsbury over to us, and Sir William Stanley has come over to my side. There will be others." I think of the power of Warwick, and the Lancastrian affinity, and the French army that Margaret will bring, and I know that it is not enough. "I can stay tonight," he says. "I had to see you, but tomorrow I have to go to war." I can hardly believe him. "You will never leave me tomorrow." "Sweetheart, I took a risk just coming here. Warwick is holed up in Coventry and will neither surrender nor give battle, for he knows that Margaret of Anjou is coming with her army, and together they will make a mighty force. George came out and is with us, and he has brought Shrewsbury and his tenants, but it's not enough. I have to take Henry as a hostage and ride out to face her. They will be hoping that I will be cornered here, but I will take the battle to them. And if I am lucky, then I will meet Warwick and defeat him before I have to meet Margaret and defeat her." My mouth grows dry, and I swallow in fear at the thought of his facing one great general and then the great army of Margaret. "The French army will come with Margaret?" "The miracle is that she has not yet landed. We were both ready to sail at the same time. We were about to race each other to England. We have both been pinned down by the weather since February. She had her fleet ready to sail for Honfleur nearly a month ago, and she has been out and driven back by a storm over and over again. There was a gap in the wind in my favor for no more than a day. It was like magic, my love, and we got away, blown all the way to Yorkshire. But at least it gives me the chance to take them one at a time, and not face a united army led by the two of them at once. I glance at my mother at the mention of the storm, but her face is smilingly innocent. You will not go tomorrow. Sweetheart, you have me tonight. Shall we spend the time talking? We turn and go into my chamber, and he closes the door with a kick of his foot. He takes me into his arms, as he always does. Bed, wife, he says. He takes me as he has always done, passionately, as a dry man slaking his thirst. But for once, tonight, he is a different man. The smell of his hair and his skin is the same, and that is enough to make me beg for his touch. But after he has had me, he holds me tightly in his arms, as if for once the pleasure is not enough. It is as if he wants something more from me. Edward, I murmur. Are you all right? He does not answer, but buries his head against my shoulder and my neck, as if he would block out the world with the warmth of my flesh. Sweetheart, I was afraid, he says. I can hardly hear him, he speaks so low. Sweetheart, I was most afraid. Of what? I ask, a foolish question of a man who has had to flee for his life, and put together an army in exile, and is facing the most powerful army in Christendom. He turns and lies on his back, his hand still gripping me close to his side, so I press against him from breastbone to toes. When they said Warwick was coming for me, and George with him, I knew this time he would not take me and hold me. I knew this time it would be my death. I have never thought anyone would kill me before, but I knew Warwick would, and I knew George would let him. But you got away. I ran, he said. It was not a careful retreat, my love. It was not a maneuver. It was a rout. I ran in fear of my life, and all the time I knew myself for a coward. I ran and left you. It is not cowardice to get away from an enemy, I say. Anyway, you have come back to face him. I ran, and I left you and the girls to face him, he says. I find I don't think well of myself for that. I didn't run to London for you. I didn't get here and make a desperate stand. I ran to the nearest port, and I took the first boat. Anyone would have done so. I never blamed you. I lean up on my elbow and look down into his face. You had to get away to get an army together and come back to save us. Everyone knew that. And my brother went with you, and your brother Richard. They judged it the right thing to do as well. I don't know what they felt while they were running like deer, but I know what I felt. I was as scared as a child with a bully coming after him. I fall silent. I don't know how to comfort him or what to say. He sighs. I have been fighting for my kingdom or for my life ever since I was a boy. And in all that time I never thought I might lose. I never thought I would be captured. I never thought I would die. It's odd, isn't it? You will think me foolish. But in all that long time, even when my father was killed and my brother too, I never thought it could happen to me. I never thought it would be my head chopped off and stuck on a spike on the city walls. I thought myself unbeatable, invulnerable. I wait. And now I know I am not, he says. I have told no one this. I will tell no one but you. But I am not the man you married, Elizabeth. You married a boy who knew no fear. I thought that meant I was brave, but I was not brave. I was just lucky. Until now. Now I am a man, and I have felt fear and fled from it. I am about to say something to comfort him, a sweet lie. But then I think I will tell him the truth. It's a fool who is afraid of nothing, I say. And a brave man is one who knows fear and rides out and faces it. You ran then, but you are back now. Are you going to run away from battle tomorrow?
God, no.
I smile. Then you are the man I married. For the man I married was a brave young man, and you are a brave man still. The man I married had not known fear, nor had he a son, nor did he know love. But all these things have come to us, and we are changed by them, but not spoiled by them. He looks at me gravely. You mean this? I do, I say, and I too have been very afraid, but I am not afraid with you here again. He draws me even closer. I think I will sleep now, he says, comforted like a little boy, and I hold him tenderly, as if he were my little boy. I wake in the morning, wondering at my joy, at the silky feel of my skin, at the warmth in my belly, at my sense of renewal and life. And then he stirs beside me, and I know that I am safe, that he is safe, that we are together once more, and that this is why I have woken with sunshine on my bare skin. Then, in the next moment, I remember that he must go, and though he is now stirring, he is not smiling this morning. That shakes me again. Edward is always so confident, but this morning his face is grim. Don't say one word to delay me, he says, getting out of the bed and throwing on his clothes. I cannot bear to go. I cannot stand to leave you again. If you hold me back, I swear I will falter. Smile and wish me good luck, sweetheart. I need your blessing. I need your courage. I swallow my fear. You have my blessing, I say, strained. Always you have my blessing, and all the good luck in the world. I try to sound bright, but my voice quavers. Are you going right away? I am going to fetch Henry, that they have been calling King, he says. I will take him with me as a hostage. I saw him yesterday at his rooms in the tower before I came to you. He knew me. He said that he knew he would be safe with me, his cousin. He was like a child, poor thing. He did not seem to know that he had been king again. There is only one king of England, I say staunchly. And there has only been one king of England since you were crowned. I shall see you in a few days, he says. And I'll go now without saying goodbye to your mother or the girls. It's better like this. Let me go quickly.
Would you even have breakfast? I don't mean to wail, but I can hardly bear to let him go.
I'll eat with the men.
Of course, I say brightly.
And my boys? I'll take them with me. They can serve as messengers. I'll keep them as safe as I can. I feel my heart plunge in terror for them, too.
Good, I say. Besides, you will be back within the week, won't you?
God willing, he says.
This is the man who used to swear to me that he was born to die in his bed with me beside him. Never before has he said, God willing. Always before it has been his will, not God's.
He pauses in the doorway. If I die, then get yourself and the children away to Flanders, he says. There is a poorhouse at Tournai where a man owes me a favor. He is a bastard cousin or something to your mother's family. He would take you in as his kinswoman. He has a story ready to account for you. I went to see him, and we agreed how it should be done in time of need. I have paid him money already and written his name down for you. It is on the table in your room. Read it, and then burn it. You can stay with him, and when the hunt is over, you can get a house of your own. but hide there for a year or two. When my son is grown, he can claim his own, perhaps.
Don't speak.